Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
To have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lover.
It's time for the weekly tips from the publishing guru, Todd Rutherford, back with us, founder of AskThePublishingGuru.com. And as a consultant, he's been involved with the writing, publishing, and marketing of more than 2,500 different books and counting. Todd, hey, welcome back.
Good to be here, Michael.
How are you?
I'm doing great, actually. I shouldn't cough as much this week as I have been recently. I'm on some stronger medication to try to control my asthma.
Oh, I got to tell you, there must be asthma or something around here, because I woke up this morning. Finally, it's starting to get warmer, but it's humid, and the allergies are out there. So we can spend we can spend 20 minutes sneezing.
Easily, yeah.
Okay, let's get to the real stuff that everybody's waiting to hear. Web, social media presence. Now, how much of that should an author actually have?
Well, you know, it's something I deal with on a daily basis as I'm consulting with 5 to 6 new authors a day. The question that I always receive is, do I really need a website as an author? And, what about Facebook? What about Twitter? That type of thing. And you know, I tell authors, regardless of whether you are pursuing self-publishing path or the traditional publishing path, your web presence and social media presence is the most important part of the foundation that you have to lay as an author. If you want to pursue a career as an author, you must have a congruent and well-developed web and social media presence, because that's your platform, especially in the new society and new technology and the way everything's moving towards digital, connecting with people and developing a following, developing a network of people that you are influencing. It not only helps you to promote the book that you currently have that you're promoting, but it also works to develop your monetary value in the marketplace for major publishers and things like that in the future, for your second book, your third book, and so on and so forth, because you have a built-in market. But if you don't have a strong, established web and social media presence, then you're not developing anything that's actually going to make any, long-term significant impact.
Now, by the way, Todd, what I love about with what you do, and I've been around authors for many, many years now, and when someone decides to become an author, they don't realize what they're getting into. Not only do you have to be an author, you have to be a marketer, you have to be a presenter, you have to be a networker, and then when you consult with somebody, they get an idea of everything that they have to do and the direction that they have to go. I have talked to so many authors over the years that, okay, I wrote a book, now what? And they don't realize that once the book is done, that's the beginning. It's not sitting down and putting it to pen.
That's true. And the regardless, once again, of whether you pursue the traditional or self-publishing path, you're developing your web presence and your social media presence is not something that the publisher is going to do for you. So you're either going to need to do it yourself or hire a professional to do it. And, but just developing a website that looks halfway decent, whether you try to do it yourself or have a professional do it, and setting up a Twitter page and a Facebook page and YouTube page, for instance, which are the bare minimums that I recommend, just setting them up, and even if you set them all up properly, you have them all look you know, good, where they all have the same similar design and connection, flow, and feel, that's still not going to, you know, make anything actually happen. You have to, once you have everything established, you know, you have to then, you know, the crowds of would-be internet browsers will only learn about your site and your social media presence if you begin to promote it. And so, you know, understanding how to get it all set up properly and how to promote it is definitely important. And it's fundamental. You don't have a chance of pursuing a successful career as an author without having it done properly.
Okay, let's go to some specifics. Facebook, effectively. How does an author use Facebook to connect?
Well, you know, Facebook is really powerful as a part of the process, and I'll throw out one number that kind of paints the picture. There are currently 500 million people using Facebook on a daily basis. And so it's definitely the largest and one of the most powerful social media platforms for developing connections. A lot of people think of Facebook and they think, oh, that's, you know, you just that's where you can connect with your friends and family and people that you went to school with from years ago and so on and so forth. But what's powerful about Facebook and what a lot of people don't realize is that it's one of the easiest platforms to be able to search for your audience. You can log into your Facebook account and just in the site's top little search bar, put in the phrase, say, cooking, for instance, and it's going to pull up several different results, and what you're looking for is any results that say group or page, because those are actual groups that have been formed of people that are excited about cooking, and even fan pages of people that are involved in certain types of cooking or interested in certain information related to cooking. In fact, if you take a look at just the group cooking the area of interest portion of cooking on Facebook, 5.7 million people have actually indicated that they are interested in cooking. So if you have a cookbook, you got 5.7 million potential customers that I can teach you, or you can learn if you start studying, because we obviously don't have enough time to cover it today, but you can learn very easily how to connect with those people. And you won't be able to connect with all 5.7 million at one time, but you can begin connecting directly with people who you are certain have an interest in cooking. And you pick the topic. You can do it with any topic, whether it's business networking or whether it's parenting or romance novels or fantasy novels, or there's so many different groups and categories of interest and fan pages that you can find and connect with people that are going to be very, you know, pre-inclined based on what information you are able to find on Facebook to be someone that might buy your book, and you can begin to connect with them. That's what's powerful.
No, by the way, that's Facebook. Now, do you have the same audience on Twitter, or is it a different audience and a different tack to take?
It's a different audience. There are some people that use both Facebook and Twitter, but for the most part, people who started on Facebook as their first social media platform have a tendency to use that as their primary social media platform, and that's how they prefer to interact. That's where they go to first. Twitter, however, there are 150 million users on Twitter, and it's the fastest growing social media platform in the world. And there are the people who use Twitter have a tendency to be people who don't use Facebook as often. So it really, you're maybe 80% of the people on Twitter don't use Facebook, and 80% of the people on Facebook don't use Twitter. You have, you know, you're getting some crossover. So it's definitely worthwhile developing a platform on both. But what's powerful about Twitter, see, the default setting on Facebook, when you set up a new Facebook account, the default setting is for your information and your conversations to be protected. So people can't see your conversations. They can only see them if they request to be your friend and you grant them permission to be your friend. Then they can see your conversations. So it's more difficult to find out to find people who are actually talking about what you do, what you've written about, what your novel is about, you know, what kind of genre that you write in, those types of things. But you can still use it by doing the searching for the different groups and fan pages that are related to your topic. So it's still possible, but a little bit more difficult. With Twitter, it is the easiest platform for finding people who are actually talking about your subject or your genre, because the default setting for a Twitter account is for your conversation to be accessible by anybody. So unless you specifically tell Twitter when you're setting up your account that you want your conversations to be protected, then they're public. And so, you know, that's obviously, we're sitting on a whole other level. That can be both good and bad, because you need to be careful what you tweet. Don't tweet like if you're a real attractive single lady, you wouldn't want to constantly be tweeting your location. Or, hey, I'm here on the corner of 11th and Main at this Quick Trip. Having a stalker use that to harm you. But from a marketing perspective of trying to connect with people as an author that are talking about your subject, they actually, and this is completely organic, that's what's powerful. It's not something created. Twitter just kind of evolved into this, where a lot of people thought, well, Twitter's just, you know, a bunch of teenage kids, you know, just talking about silly, stupid things like, hey, I'm at the store with my buddies or whatever, or I'm at the mall, or I'm at the movies. But what Twitter's become referred to and as a very powerful tool is, it is a conversation, it has become a way for two things, dissemination of information, where, like, if I find an article, for instance, if you follow at the Publishing Guru, which is my Twitter alias, where I find articles and magazines and clips on the internet and fascinating stories that are helpful, that would be helpful to a writer having to do with writing, publishing, or marketing books, then I send out a tweet with a little headline and a link to that article. So if you follow me, you're going to have access to 15 to 20 new articles and web posts and blog posts a day that are going to be helpful for you as a writer or someone involved in the publishing or book marketing process. And that's one of the powerful things about Twitter. But also, what happens is people start conversations and they use something called a hashtag. And basically all that is the pound sign and then whatever the subject is. And so when someone's talking about, for instance, cookbooks, if people are talking about cookbooks, they'll have a tendency to put pound cookbooks in their tweet so that anybody else that wants to join in on the conversation that they're having about cookbooks or about nonprofits or about vampire novels or whatever the case might be, or about even a certain, you know, movie star, you can right now go to Twitter and you go to search.twitter.com. And if you put in the pound sign and then cookbooks all together with no spacing, it'll pull up hundreds and hundreds and even thousands of people that right now or within the last 30 minutes are actually in a conversation with them, with a group of people or two or three people talking about cookbooks. So if you're a cookbook author, this is a powerful way to connect once again directly with people who are most likely going to be interested in buying your book. And what you can do you can follow them. That's how you do it on Twitter. On Facebook, you would actually ask somebody to be your friend who's like part of a cookbook group or part of a cookbook fan page. You would then click on them and ask them to be your friend. And if they find, then they're going to check you out, see that you're an author of a cookbook and say, yeah, I want to be this person's friend. And then they end up possibly buying your book. Same thing on Twitter. Everybody who's talking about cookbooks, you can click on them and say follow, and you'll follow them, and then they'll get a notification that you're following them, and they'll turn around and follow you back after they see that you're a cookbook author, because they're most likely going to be interested in what you have to say about cooking. And there's just no more effective way than using social media like this. It doesn't cost anything. It's going to take you some of your time. Now, you can't hire a professional to help you set it all up that type of thing. But relatively speaking, it is not extremely difficult to learn and not extremely difficult to manage.
Now, by the way, one more time, how do you find those categories again, Don?
someone, they like on Twitter, they would need to go, both Facebook and Twitter, for example, have search bars. And you basically, in Facebook, you just put the topic, whatever the topic is. If it's cookbook, if you're looking for people interested in cookbooks, you just put cookbooks in there. So whatever your subject or genre is, you put that in there, and it'll start listing groups and fan pages that are related to that you can connect with, that will give you access to people that you can connect with. And then on Twitter, you actually, in their search bar, you just put the hashtag, which would be pound, the pound sign, the number sign, and then whatever the keyword is or the subject is. So like pound cookbooks, and search for it, and it'll pull up all the people talking about cookbooks so that you can actually begin to connect with them.
Now, another area that's skyrocketed in the last couple of years, people used to talk about blogging, which was no big deal, but man, you can make money with it, and blogging is a great way to get coverage out there too.
Well, yeah, the blogosphere is often overlooked, and in my opinion, it's the single most effective place for social media and web marketing. Because not only do you need to have a blog as an author where at least once a week you are putting something on your blog that's related to your subject matter or your genre, and because then people begin to connect with your blog and want to follow your blog because they see you as a source of information on that topic or genre. But what's also powerful about blogs that people don't realize is connecting and getting exposure on other people's blogs as an author. Because literally, there are millions of blogs out there. And I don't care if it's from the blogger that's a mom that just reads book in her spare times, but she writes something on her blog about the book after she reads it. They call this a book blogger. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of book bloggers out there. They may only have 50 to 100 people that follow their recommendations, but every single one of those book bloggers that you can get in touch with and you can get to let you send them a free PDF of your book or even a free copy of a printed version, if they agree to read it and post something on their blog, that's 50 to 100 potential buyers that they're going to give you access to. And some of them will even interview you and ask you about your whole experience by email and then post that interview on their blog. And starting at the small level, but there are literally we've been able to help authors to get book reviews on some of the huge blogs, like SheKnows.com is a blog that has more than 4 million unique monthly visitors. And so it's possible to, get a lot of exposure for your book, even as a self-published author, because one of the challenges that self-published authors face is getting, having credibility. In newspapers, magazine, radio, TV, a lot of times they don't give very much respect to a self-published author. But bloggers, they could care less. And there's so many of them, you have a lot more opportunity, and there's more of them that are hungry for content and stuff to put on their blogs. And so, my recommendation to folks regarding looking for blogs, and working with blogs is, find 10 to 15 blogs that you'd like to target as possible outlets for your content. And you can use, there's a couple different tools out there like alltop.com, that's alltop.com. It's a search engine for blogs, and you can actually find and create a list of blogs for your particular subject or genre. And then you can use a tool like compete.com, which is a free tool. You just put a blog's name in there, and they'll tell you how many followers that blog has or unique monthly visitors that blog has, and you can determine whether or not the blog is worth pursuing, and then trying to basically connect with them and seeing if they are willing to review your book or interview you as an author or let you be a guest blogger to write an article for them. And also Twitter is a phenomenal place to get recommendations, blog recommendations, and even to meet different blog editors because they use Twitter to send out links to their blog posts. So you can even do searches for the word blog and then a certain subject matter, and potentially find blogs that way as well. But once you've got a list of 10 to 15 sizable blogs with your ideal audience following them, then you can kind of start getting used to them and reading out what they like to do and how they what they like to talk about. And then you can even begin to comment on some of their posts to start developing where they know who you are and see your name. And then you can begin to connect with them and actually ask them to consider reviewing your book.
Now, Todd, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Again, website we can find you at.
The best way to get in touch with me is askthepublishingguru.com. It's my blog. More than 350 articles now on writing, publishing, and marketing books. And I offer a free 30-minute consultation to anyone regarding writing, publishing, or marketing books. And we'll help you in any way that we can.
No, and by the way, when it really comes down to it, the information that you give everybody every week, the tips, the strategies to use, if they listen to it very closely, you're talking about the availability of making $10, $20, $50, $100,000 on your projects. And people don't realize that if you don't get out there, if you don't get heard, you don't get seen, nobody's going to buy anything.
One of the biggest challenges, you know, authors, you know, they, like you just said, I publish my book, now what? And I mean, I talk to hundreds of authors a week, I mean, on average, whether it's quick communications, answering questions on Twitter or Facebook or an actual, you know, 30-minute consultation that I'm doing or a full-blown consultation once I'm working with somebody on some level. But, you know, I just hear over and over again that there's the assumption that I can just publish my book or get my book published and then I'm done. I'm going to be able to just collect my royalty checks. And unfortunately, that's just not reality. If you really want to develop a career out of being a successful author, you have to develop your platform of influence and your network and your databases. And there's no more effective way to do that than having a solid, firm web and social media foundation.
No question. Hey, Todd Rutherford, thank you, and we'll see you next week.
All right, sir. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Brad Taylor with us, Lieutenant Colonel retired, who's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Army Infantry Special Forces, including 8 years with the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta, popularly known as Delta Force. He retired in 2010. He is the author of One Rough Man Beyond Special Forces Lies, Our Last Line of Defense. Brad, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, when we take a look at it, when you talk about One Rough Man, when you're the character in your book, if we could all put ourselves in that person's life, in that person's mind, what would we see? How would we see ourselves almost on a daily basis in a life that we live?
Well, actually, that's one of the main reasons I wanted to write the book was 9 times out of 10, the characters that you see in books like this or in movies or anything like that, it's some guy who, you know, if the bureaucracy would get off my back and I was allowed to torture everybody and I'd run around and I'd save the day. The truth of the matter is I've served with a lot of those guys, and they all operate with a moral compass, and they make life and death decisions that have repercussions after the fact occurred. And I wanted to show what would somebody who really does this for a living, how does he act, how does he think? They fear, they're human, all those emotions are there. It's not that none of them are superhuman.
Sure, yeah, and especially today with everything that's going on, you know, with I guess the big question is now is why would we be afraid to waterboard, but it's okay to go shoot somebody in the head? And I think those questions, most people who have not been exposed to it, gets lost. And I think this in and of itself really says it as far as how the audience can participate in the book. Pike's journey of redemption from a dangerous trained killer who has lost his purpose and control to a hero. Most people get out there and they lose their control, they lose their purpose, and they're lost. And I can see that many, many people would see themselves within Pike.
Yeah, I think so. And what you mentioned about the waterboarding and all the other questions that are going on now, I didn't intend to put that theme in the book. The theme of the greater good permeates the entire book. At the one stage, the organization itself that he belongs to, the task force, is an illegal organization, but it was created for the greater good of defeating terrorism. I mean, they all say, you know, when is this thing going to get out of control? But right now, we need it. The terrorists themselves, I tried to write the terrorists as accurately as I could, and I've unfortunately met some terrorists, and they're not, you know, Dr. Evil. They're human beings as well, and they believe what they're doing is for the greater good of humankind. Of course, they hate the infidel, and we don't count, but they believe they're doing something for the greater good. And that theme kind of works its way through the book, and I liked it because it's really any national security debate we have, the United States of America, that's where it falls. So right now, when someone says, you know, we should do XYZ type interrogation method, most people would say, no, you shouldn't do that because it's just inherently not the characteristics of the United States of America. And then somebody says, yeah, but what if that guy's got a nuclear bomb? Well, you've entered the greater good at that point. You've sacrificed something to get something else.
Oh, no question about it. I've always believed for many, many years now, Brad, that you can't take a knife to a gunfight. You have to fight fire with fire. And if you're dealing with an enemy who does these things, you know, they destroy churches, they kill people, they behead people. I mean, this list goes on. You can't stand above it and say these are our values as they're killing us. There comes that time where you've got to stand up for your country and the people that live in your country and the people that are battling this. I just don't quite understand their mindset.
Well, I'll tell you that's a moral dilemma. And at the end of the day, I mean, you've been told your entire life, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that, the Ten Commandments. And then when you get into combat, make no mistake, it's a mortal limit the minute you hit it. You're being told right off the bat that it's time, you know, here's your weapon, go kill this guy. And the decisions that people make on the ground are very, very hard decisions to do, and they have ramifications. It's not a black and white world. It's not as simple as you know, I'd go torture that guy in a heartbeat. Okay, well, you'd say that sitting on your couch. If you see the pain that guy's going through, maybe you change your mind.
But also, too, it's what's beyond it, you know, and I think that example, and many people have used it at this stage of the game, Brad, you know, if your family is there, if they know, you know, if you got somebody that you've got cornered and they know where your family is in danger, I don't think that torture or anything else is going to stop you from getting the information that you want. I really believe when it really comes down to it, you know, somebody joins the military, it's a completely different mindset, it's a different way of life, and you're looking at things differently. You're trained to do a particular thing. And the people on the outside don't see this. The kids that are demonstrating against the military, yada, yada. It's that very military that allows them to be able to demonstrate. That's what they're not getting.
Well, I'll tell you, there's two things they're not getting. Number one, it's exactly what you say. They live in a world that I protect. But the number two, they don't understand the moral mindset of the person who's doing it. They have this vision, because of these other stereotypes that are out there, that we're all out there, you know, like the Huns, killing everybody in sight and doing whatever we want to. That's not the case. When all these actions occur, no matter where they are in the battlefield, they're well thought out, and there's a moral repercussion because of it. You're doing something that you think is the right at the time, and you're making a moral judgment on the scene at that time. You're not doing something just because you're some bloodthirsty killer.
No. As a matter of fact, and you don't come in as a bloodthirsty killer. There are people, there are no question about it, Brad, there are people who have a propensity to want to be a bloodthirsty killer. But that's a very small percentage of the people who go. I knock on wood, I was in the Marine Corps, and I was I was in, you know, before Nam and after Korea. So I was in at that place where there wasn't combat. I would have gone, but at the same time, I remember somebody, it was when the Bush's last election when he won, that I had said to a youngster at the university, I said, well, guess who won? You know, my guy, not yours. And she turned around and looked at me and she said, are you a child killer? You know, I mean, that's the problem that we have today. There is a tremendous misunderstanding of the value of our military, the value of what the military does, and the protection that the military affords.
And I think the misunderstanding is even deeper than that, that most people don't realize that the fabric of the military is a reflection of the fabric of society as a whole.
Sure.
Even in the Korean War, you mentioned the Korean War, there's a great book, This Kind of War, it's a classic, and in there he has a quote, you know, we went to Korea, we really got our butt kicked, Pusan Perimeter, we were getting slaughtered left and right. And the reason for that was that World War II had ended, we never invested any infrastructure in the military. And his quote is, we believe the tigers were gone, and it turned out the tigers were real, and we weren't prepared to do it. And there was a lot of discussion about, you know, all those guys are cowards, you know, what happened in Korea? And his point was, hey, that's American society. You raise these people to be like this, and this is what happened. And it's the same in the way it is today. People that say that you go out and fight the war on terror like I've done, and I'm different than the average American, I'm not. I'm a reflection of American society.
Yeah. And by the way, when you really come down to it, and I can't remember what his name was, but during the Vietnam War, we won at the Tet Offensive, we won, it was over with. But the general on the other side who was leading the charge, his memoirs, I can't remember what his name is.
I know the quote you're talking about. That's true, but it's also irrelevant.
Well, let me make a point. His memoirs afterwards basically said that because of the peace marches and the rest of it and the demonstrations, they got encouraged from that. I mean, we encourage them to continue on. I think the key is if everybody understood the way the military operates and the purpose of the military, we wouldn't be out there demonstrating for something we don't know about, and Jane Fonda wouldn't be sitting on sitting on ammunition, or I'm sorry, weapons, and making it look like she's on the other side. There's the problem, and I think the biggest problem is the lack of communication and understanding.
I agree. And actually, that quote I was talking about at the negotiation tables in 1973, yeah. A military member from our side of the house said, you know, you never defeated us on the battlefield. We kicked your butt every time we got into battle. And his response was, that's true, but it's also irrelevant. And it's exactly what you're bringing up. At the end of the day, we attacked your center of gravity without you even knowing it, which was our own people protesting and turning against the war.
And for whatever reason the decision was made, and really has to do with what goes on in your book, this last decision about getting bin Laden, very interesting. I think the world was expecting if we did that to him, there would be an uprising like we would never see again. It's been very quiet, and I don't think it's going to ever get back as bad as it was, because we finally said, if you do it, we're going to find you, and we're going to hunt you down.
Yeah, I think a lot of that, though, I chased that guy for a long number of years. And everybody knew, there was a big thing about, you know, if we get bin Laden, there's going to be this uprising. And I never bought into that, and I tell you, it's not just me, there's smarter people than me that never bought into it, because everybody knows he dropped the Twin Towers. He hit the coal. He blew up the embassies in Tanzania. And everybody knows he's a combatant. And it was more of a, well, what do you know, they finally got him. I mean, it's not like, you know, oh, he's a martyr. They all knew he was going to get caught sooner or later, and so there was not this big uprising. The good thing about that, though, is that it does show his infallibility is not real, and it'll hurt his recruiting and his funding and everything else. It's a great psychological blow.
Then let me say this from your military experience, though. This is basically what goes on today. We buy things from China. We buy things from China, and a lot of the goods are they're tainted. Some of them are poisonous, and so on and so forth. But they take that money that we give them, they loan us money back, but at the same time, they're building their military. We have put out billions of dollars over the years to countries who build their military ending up against us. There's something wrong with that picture.
Yeah, I agree. At the end of the day, they're almost a near competitor of us, and people who talk about you know, we're spending so much money on defense and things like that, which I'm not, you know, obviously that's outside my lane to discuss how the financial, you know, impact of that goes. But at the end of the day, they're going to be a near peer competitor with us. And make no mistake, they're into total war, and they're you know, they have hegemonic ambitions just like everybody else over there.
Now, by the way, I go through the book, I read it page by page, cover to cover. Brad, what's my takeaway? What do I get that I didn't have before I read the book? What am I going to walk away with?
At the end of the day, what I honestly hope people walk away is just a damn good read. I wanted to write a book. I left the unit, Delta, and I came down to teach, and I had a lot of time on my hands. And I've always wanted to write a novel. I'm a voracious reader. And so I wrote a book that I thought others would want to read. I have no real... There's no political message in it. It's about as apolitical as I could make it. I just wanted to have a very realistic look at the war on terror, counterterrorism, special forces, and covert action.
Now, by the way, one of the things in your press release, which is, and I think everybody should take a look at it from this angle also, you know, one of the themes is how far government should really go to protect the greater good. That is a very powerful theme and a very powerful message. And if more people understood that, I'm almost at a point now where I think that when kids get out of high school, they should go into the military for a couple of years, get a little bit of, learn something called discipline and a little bit of respect and come back and live life. And I think that's the one thing that we're missing in society today. You go into the military, you're taught discipline. You're also taught respect. And that's something that you can't get in too many places today.
I agree, and I completely agree with the discipline and respect for the individual person himself. They definitely get that. But I think it's a greater contribution to the society as a whole. If everybody were in the military, then it wouldn't be this disconnected, I've never known anybody in the military, and these myths that go on about they're bloodthirsty killers, all they want to do is kill people. You would have it be permeated throughout society. It is a reflection of society. It always has been, especially in America. Especially in America, because of word democracy, it's a direct reflection of our society, and it should be supported one way or the other.
Oh, sure. And how do you get the world, that multinational world out there, to respect us when our kids come back and they get spit at by our own people? I think that in and of itself, you know, it sends a message, and that message is weakness, and as long as they feel that, they're going to still attack. I really believe, and I haven't been exposed to it, I'm speaking from a place of what I'm gathering based on my outside information, but when it really comes down to it, they've got to respect us. The one thing that they respect is strength, and if we don't show any strength, they're going to do everything that they can possibly do because they know one thing, there won't be a repercussion. There's not going to be consequence for it, and thank goodness that Bin Laden got it, only because that's the first step in saying, hey, don't tangle with us.
Yeah, I think that, though, in America we like to turn everything into a black and white world, and your comment of they respect us. The problem with counterterrorism and insurgency and the war we're in right now, which, make no mistake, it is a war, is the they is not defined. The they are making the decisions based on our actions right now. So some things we do cause they to become real. There could be a guy who is going to go through life and never do one single thing against America. And we do something that we think is showing strength, and instead we blow up a wedding party or whatever, not out of malicious actions because we made a mistake.
Sure.
And that guy becomes they. So it's a very delicate balance as to how we apply force and when we apply force.
That's why the they, and because it's the they that can be anybody. It's not specific. And there's where the problem is. And I think one of the major problems we're facing today, you looking at it from a military perspective, is those people at Gitmo. You bring them here, all of a sudden they're under civilian law. If we're dealing with a war criminal, if people have declared war, even though we can't specifically define the country, they're still a war criminal, and they don't fall under the auspices of our legal system.
Oh, yeah, make no mistake, I'm 100% supportive of that. I've chased terrorists all over the world, and I've captured quite a few of them, and once those guys get caught, I mean, you made your choice. Rightly or wrongly, whatever you did it, you made your choice, and welcome to the big rigs, because I completely agree. When something like that happens, there's absolutely... We made a mistake in the 80s, in my opinion, in the 80s of treating this all as a criminal action, that, you know, this guy's no better than a bank robber. We'll put the bank robber on trial, we'll put the terrorist on trial. It's not like that. The bank robber's doing it for his own personal gain. He's got something he's doing. He's breaking the law for his own personal gain. the terrorist is doing for a global jihad. He care less. He wants to be on stage. Yeah, put me on trial. I can spout off all my hatred I want to. It's good publicity for them. It's a different phenomenon. It is not a criminal phenomenon. It's war.
No, no question about it. Brad, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, sure. You can go to bradtaylorbooks.com, and you can read an excerpt of the book itself and see if you like it. And I actually have a blog there, too, where I blog about all these things we're talking about.
Wonderful. Hey, Brad, but thank you for being on the show, and thank you for all the work that you've done. And I hope a lot of people buy the book and start to get it once and for all.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night, Brad.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you've adored for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Welcome back. We're going to talk about JFK. Don Becker with us, proudly served in the Air Force for over 22 years, with part of his service being in Desert Storm. He's a graduate of the University of Phoenix and a business management degree. His real interest is in American history and politics. He is the author of The JFK Assassination, A Researcher's Guide. And let's say, Don, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, by the way, do we really know what happened? After all of these years, there has been so much confusion over the death of him. You know, was it Oswald? Was there only one shot? I mean, my goodness, this must have taken years to put together.
Yes, it did. It took quite a long time. And I don't think anybody's ever going to really know the full story. Even when I released the archive files from the Warren Commission, they're still not going to get it because the CIA, and they always seem to sanitize any information they give out. So even at that point, we're still not going to find out the truth.
Now, with the Warren Commission, and obviously they did the best job they could possibly do, did they really have it together? Because from what I understand, and stop me if I'm wrong here, J.F. Kane's brain disappeared too, didn't it?
That's correct. It did. When he got to the morgue, a couple of the corpsmen that were there said when they unwrapped his body and his head, there was nothing in it but an empty cavity.
Yeah, and they haven't found it to this day. So
that's
when
correct.
when we're really dealing with it, we don't really know if it was the mafia. We don't know if it was Castro. We don't. I mean, this list goes on with the confusion about it. But was there anything with all of your research that you found that you could tie down to say this is it, and it's going to come out finally?
I don't think anybody's going to be able to do that. But I think I narrowed it down a little bit. You were talking about Castro, Cubans, the KGB.
Sure.
None of those agencies could do this on their own, okay? None of them could. They would have to have some inside help someplace. It's a definite conspiracy. There's no doubt about that. okay? It is conspiracy, and for all the things that took place, especially the misinformation from the CIA and the FBI, there's no way the Cuba, the exiled Cubans, the anti-Castro Cubans per se, the Castro people, the KGB, the Chinese, the Mossad, none of those could have done this on their own. Not even the Mafia could have done this on their own.
Now, by the way, who was it that was who was it that was the head of the FBI at the time that happened?
I think his name was McCune.
Okay, but wasn't there a bit of a problem? Wasn't JFK when it came to running the country, the secrets, the whatever, they couldn't keep him down. They couldn't control him. And one of the theories that I've heard in the last, I don't know, 5-10 years, is that it actually came from within. It was one of our governmental agencies that stopped him.
When you say stopped him, you mean
killed him.
Killed. Okay. I kind of don't think it was one of the agencies. I think it was several rogue elements from some of the agencies.
Okay. Yeah, so when is that what all of the evidence really starts to lead to, that it came from within our own agencies that caused his death?
Yes, because they're the only ones that could have done the cover-up, you know. The CIA was the masters of misinformation. And if you read all the books, there's so much contradictory information. That's why this is like a big spider web. And it's hard to keep track of what all is going on. And that's one of the things that got me to write a book. I was reading all these articles and the books and stuff, and I was having trouble keeping track of what was going on. So I just started making notes. Finally, one thing led to another. My wife seen all this, you know, these files, and thought, why don't you just write a book? So I did, you know.
Yeah.
But the point is, there's just so much information and there's so much contradictory information. It's hard to keep track of what's going on. And this whole subject will drive you crazy if you let it.
Oh, I'm sure it will. Was it Magruder? Who was it? Who took the pictures that disappeared and they finally got back?
Magruder.
Yeah, right. And there were pictures that he actually took. And I think, and I'm going to give you an I think, I haven't touched this subject for a long time now, but I think what they saw in the pictures is there were a couple of holes. There were shots coming from different directions. It wasn't just one shot from Oswald.
That's correct. Well, actually, it wasn't Oswald anyway. Let's say the sniper window. It wasn't
okay.
Just one shot from the sniper window. Okay, because Oswald was not the shooter.
Was Oswald up there in the first place? What was he doing?
He was not up there. There's no way. If you look at a timeline, and that's what I did in the book, I created a timeline so people would understand a little bit more of what's going on. If you look at the timeline, at 12:15, he was seen by one of the secretaries eating lunch in the second floor cafeteria. Eating lunch, not getting done, but eating lunch. Now, one of the things you got to keep in mind here is the motorcade was scheduled to go by the Texas School Book Depository at 12:25. Now, if he was supposed to be up there in the sniper's nest by 12:25, he wouldn't be eating his lunch at 12:15, I wouldn't think.
No.
So he was still down there. Now, the other thing is, at 12:20, there's this guy named Billy Ray Williams, I think his name was. He was eating lunch up on the sixth floor, and he didn't see Oswald or anybody else. So that means whoever was up there, well, it wasn't Oswald, obviously, because he knew him. There was no time for Oswald to get up there, get in a position, and be prepared to shoot the president at 12:25 if he was still downstairs by 12:20. You understand?
Sure. No, okay. I'm just listening to you. Go ahead.
On the other side, after the shooting was done, they claimed that Oswald took his three shots, squeezed out of the little sniper's nest, ran 100 feet down to the west, 100 feet north, and then hid the gun under a couple boxes, wiped off the prints, of course, and then ran down four flights of stairs without being seen, and then was down in the second floor lunchroom again when police officer Marion Baker stopped him. He couldn't have done that.
By the way, Don, let me ask you this. Do you think, that from all of your research, do you think they had Oswald targeted to take the hit, the blame, or was it just happenstance? He was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I think he was targeted to take the blame. He was the patsy. He knew something was going on because of his behavior before he even went to work. The stuff he left behind at home, you know, his ring and some other things that he left at home, which was out of the ordinary. And then when it happened, he left work. You know, why would he leave work? He knew something was wrong, you know. And then his description was given out 15 minutes after the assassination took place. He had something to do with it, but we just don't know what.
Now he had been down to Cuba, hadn't he, before that?
Well, they said Mexico. He went down to Mexico City to get a visa to go to Cuba and to Russia, but he never got it. And they're not 100% sure he actually went to Mexico City either. The picture the CIA showed was not of Oswald.
I wonder if Oswald knew, and we don't know this. We didn't know his mind. I wonder if Oswald knew that he was going to take the hit for it. And if he did know that, if he knew something, if he knew that that's the way it was going to be, there had to be something very strong behind him to make him take those steps to validate whatever his mindset was about what's right and what's wrong.
Right. But I don't know if he really had the full scope of what was going on. The thing is, I don't understand about him is he wasn't stupid. He was supposed to be a pretty smart individual. He should have been able to catch on what was happening. But he did some stupid moves. One is he went to his boarding house and got his gun. If he wasn't guilty of something, why would he take his gun? You know?
True.
Oswald.
Absolutely. And by the way, you know, there were different, and time after time we've seen this. We've seen the reports. We've seen that the different bullet trajectories actually indicate that there were different shooters. They were in different places. It didn't come from one spot.
Right. Yes, I looked at that too. And if you look, when you look at the shots, you start looking at the angles and stuff. Like, let's take the first one, Teague, okay? The first shot fired didn't come from the depository building, okay? Because of the angle. He was way down the line, and they were up about 60 feet high, you know? The trajectory is all wrong to be hitting Teague down the street 500 yards away, okay? So it had to come to someplace like the Deltex building, okay? That's one shot right there. Then the frontal shot in the throat. That throat wound was not made from coming from the rear. That was a frontal shot. There's no doubt about it. The Parkland Hospital people even said that shot was an entry wound. So it didn't come from the back either. Then the final head shot, that didn't come from the back. The people at Parkland will say the same thing. That was a front shot, and even the pictures will show you it's a front shot. So there had to be more than two shooters.
You know, the one thing that I do not understand, and I haven't yet found any sense behind this one. It was almost, you know, it's almost 50 years ago when this happened. Is anybody alive that was there, even with the Warren report, the rest of it? Most of these people are dead. And if everybody is gone at this stage of the game, what would they be hiding that would be so delicate that they didn't want to come out in the open with it today? I mean, I think that's really the question. There's nobody around to protect anymore. They're gone.
Well, that's partially true, but in actuality, if somebody came out and said something, who would believe them? Everybody believes the Warren Commission or believes this, or if anybody comes out with any kind of proof whatsoever, it's not going to mean anything to anybody. The only way we might be able to get a handle on this is if they was to get Arlen Specter, he's a congressman from Pennsylvania and he's still alive, if they could get him to come to Congress, a congressional hearing or something, because he was on the Warren Commission, and let him explain what all took place with the Warren Commission. What did they actually find? What about this magic bullet theory? That, by the way, that's all that is a theory. It's not real. He might be able to shed some light on this. And if he starts talking, maybe some other people will too, okay? But somebody with some kind of notoriety or credibility has to start talking first, because everybody else is considered a conspiracist that talks, that says anything. But he was the father of the magic bullet theory. If he starts saying the magic bullet theory was wrong, and this is what really took place, the door might be open for the truth.
But Don, when it comes down to it, and it all boils down to what it was moving towards, the government. Why cover it up after all of these years? Why is there this major secret? And it's a secret based on most people, again, maybe not Specter, but everybody else is gone. What is it that could come up that would be so devastating that it would change history? That's really the key. What, and I know I'm asking this rhetorically, who knows the answer? What don't we know? What is it that can cause a problem today?
There's nothing. There's nothing that could happen that's going to change history. It'll just change the history books, but it's not going to change history. It's just going to clear it up. That's all it would do. Nobody's going to be prosecuted because, as you said, they're all gone. Johnson's gone. Everybody else is gone. Even the shooters are gone. Even the people that helped the shooters are gone.
Yeah.
So there's not going to be any prosecution. It still would be more of a, you know, letting people know this is what really happened. And that would be it. There's no change in history.
Okay, but with all of the work that you've done, if you had the absolute power to do whatever you wanted to do, create an investigation any way you wanted to do it, what would you do to find out the reality of what happened?
Okay, if you read any of the witness, not testimonies, but when they went in front of the Warren Commission and they gave their affidavits and stuff, the Warren Commission kind of fudged some of this information, okay? If you could get that information, the real information, and, like, have a bogus trial, so to speak. Let's put Oswald on trial. If you was to put Oswald on trial, that would bring everything out. But you use the stuff, all the eyewitness dialogue that came out in the Warren Commission, and use that as your trial basis. You'd have people acting out that person and let them tell the story. And then have other people be the jury and let them decide what the truth actually is. But even with that, you still won't know if you're actually getting to the truth. I don't think there's any way to get to the truth, except for, as I said, if you can get Arlen Specter to speak up. That would be the start right there. Because some renowned forensic pathologist, they had their say and nobody's listening.
No, and then again, there's got to be a reason. Now, it's been long enough, obviously, that it's not in the forefront of what everybody thinks. But at the same time, it's still part and parcel of our history. Conspiracy theories, they come and they go. The theory that we were the ones that, you know, was the president, that was Bush that did 9/11 and yada, yada. That's silly stuff. But this is a whole different story. This is something that had to come from within. They could not have pulled it off externally. There was too many things that went on, and it got covered. I think if it was an external operation, they would have found out what it was, because all of our organizations, all of them, CIA, FBI, the rest of it, would be on it, and those guys know what they're doing, and they would have found out.
Right. That's correct. But as I said, I don't think there's any way I don't know what they're protecting, first of all. Because you know, the government right now, the situation with the government right now is there's a total mistrust from the public of the government. It's not like this is going to come out and people are going to mistrust the government. You know, that's not going to happen. That's already done. So I can't see any reason why they're holding off telling the truth.
No, neither can I. I did must have been 5-10 years ago, somewhere along those lines. I spent an entire week on authors regarding JFK, regarding the Warren Commission. I mean, the information was unbelievable how it flowed. And at the end of the week, and we're talking probably 10, 15 books, major, major authors, at the end of the week, when all was said and done, nobody knew anything more than when we started.
Right. It's too confusing.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No, there's no question about it. There is no question about it. And I don't know if we will ever find out. But, you know, you've taken the time to do this. Now, let me ask you this. Are you going to follow through? Is this it? You're done? Or are you going to move forward with it? Is there another step here?
I don't know if there's another step. I'm going to see how the book goes first. If there's no interest, there probably won't be another step, unless it's just for my own sake. You know, once again, just doing more research, adding to the information I got, that sort of thing. But as far as publishing anything, probably not.
Okay, now, by the way, to take the time to do what you're doing, the information that you've got, you know, somebody has to keep it alive. And I really believe that when you run into a situation like that, if you don't have somebody keeping it alive in one way, shape, or form, it's going to get buried based on everything that we have. They'll forget about it. And if there was a real problem, if there was an underlying conspiracy that would have caused some kind of a problem today, we're never going to find out.
That's right. That's one of the reasons why when my wife mentioned the book, I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea. In fact, it was to keep it alive, to maybe get the younger people interested so they know a little bit about what's going on, so maybe they'll learn more about it. And hopefully this will never happen again. But considering our history, the United States government does not learn. People don't learn. We're going to eventually repeat history. It's already been done four times. You know, I hate to say it, but we don't learn. Especially,
Don, I hear you loud and clear.
Pardon?
Yeah, Don, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you in the book at?
Yes, www.usadon.com.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated all the work you've done with it and being here with us tonight.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about it. It's my favorite subject.
Take care. Good night.
Thank you. Bye.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see, why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Carl Spain with us. He is the co-author of Listen to the Words. I love the title. God, I Trust America. I love. He's president and founder of Carl, president and founder and entrepreneur. As president and founder, Carl led the design development, the contract administration, installation, implementation, and also the training of a $2 million internet digital archiving system at Tommy Hilfiger at New York City and for IGF Technical Services from 2002 to 2007. Now, the contract was successfully completed on budget and on time to consumer satisfaction. And as a direct result of his work, Carl also collaborated with Microsoft on the marketing strategy for Dynamics and specialized in SAP recovery situations. And let us say, Carl Spain, hi, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much. God, I Trust, America, I Love. What was the impetus? What was the purpose of the book?
I knew this extraordinary man, Aris Martirosyan, who immigrated to this country and was highly successful once he got here. And we were talking one day about his life story. And, of course, I've written many articles. I was in the newspaper business for years before I got into the computer business. And I said, you know what, your life story is a book. And from there, we went.
Yeah, when we're dealing with his insights on American immigration, many, many years ago when my father came to this country, he came in the early 1900s, and he went through Ellis Island. And he came to the country, and he integrated into the country. He became an American. He learned the language. He still had a Russian accent, but he learned the language, and he became part and parcel of what the country was about. The people who are here, the immigrants who are here, the people that have come from all over the world to make us who we are and who we've become, I think the biggest problem that we have today is starting to get diluted. And the title in and of itself, America I Love, it is those very things that cause us to love this country that we have to be very careful about that we keep.
Well, Aris agrees with you that if you come here, you need to assimilate. In other words, you need to speak the language. You need to love this country as if it were your first country. And he has done all that. He has won the Ellis Island Medal, which is the highest honor that this country gives to an immigrant. He went to college here, both at Kansas State and at University of Maryland, and got his bachelor and then graduate and then ultimately did his coursework for his PhD. So, in other words, this is a man who came here, saw the opportunity that America is, made the most of it, made a fortune doing it, and loves this country. And this book is the incredible story of his life and what he accomplished here and how he did it.
Now, by the way, what the country in and of itself, one of the things that America was founded on was the ability to be anything that you want to be. Yes, we had some problems in the beginning, but at this stage of the game, it doesn't matter whether what your ethnicity is, what your gender is, what your religion is, whatever. There are laws to say that we can open any door. So for the most part, yes, there are still some problems, but nothing like it was. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have today, you know, God I trust, America I love, they're taking God out of everything. In America, there are people that won't even let you put a flag out in front of your house anymore. So I think with what Aris has done here, that it should be some kind of a message for everybody to say, take a look at what you got before you throw it away.
Well, and he talks about what the secrets to success are in this book. And he, if you were to ask him what they are in order, I mean, he would tell you God first, education, family, hard work, and don't quit. And that's it. If you, you know, keep God first and your family high on your priority list and you work hard and you don't quit, there's every bit as much opportunity in this country today as there ever has been, and there will always be for people who follow that simple formula, and that's what the book is also all about.
Now, by the way, the country in and of itself should be a family. It should be a situation where we don't have the division of people yelling and screaming at each other and everybody trying to be right, and, you know, there's right, there's wrong, there's whatever. There should be an American way. There should be a commonality of definition that allows us to walk in the same direction down the path.
And I think there is. I mean, if you think about it, someone from Massachusetts may not have a lot in common from someone from Texas, but you take a young man from Massachusetts and another one from Texas, and you put them in the same army unit together, and they're in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever, and they're fighting for this country, you'll find that they have a very similar set of values and ideals and bond. In other words, this country still does take people that are very different and bind them together with those core principles that I just discussed.
No, absolutely. And there's no question about that. And I think today, and especially in today's world, it's the core principles that brought us to where we are. Well, I won't say brought us to where we are, but the core principles that we should be working on and working with, sometimes they get diluted. And I think books like what the two of you have here is something to remind you what we should be, the way we started, what we built into, and what we can be. And I really believe that we are the most powerful nation in the world. Toe-to-toe, physically, you can't beat us. If anybody's going to beat us, if anybody's going to cause that to happen, what will go on is the dilution and people being separated from each other. Now, Aris, he passed away when, 1995?
No, he did not pass away. Aris is still alive. He's,
oh, I'm sorry. What am I saying? Oh, this is the appreciation thing. I look like a, tell him I'm sorry.
Okay. No. He's very much alive and kicking, and he just happens to be out of the country at the moment, and so I'm doing the interview. But he is very much alive, and if you were to look through his list of credits, I mean, the things he's done are extraordinary. He started his own a convenience store company called 612, which was a competitor with 7-Eleven and Convenience Mart out of Chicago. He has invented any number of important inventions, but the most important one of all, I would have to say, is texting. I mean, he kind of changed the world with that one. So he's an extraordinary man with an extraordinary mind.
No question. By the way, when I looked at this, I opened up the book. By the way, the book is great. I have it in front of me. I opened up the book, and it looked like a memorial, but it's an appreciation of for outstanding contribution. Okay, we tried that. So he's the one who invented texting, huh?
That is correct.
No, well, you see that, he can go through history knowing this. When a couple meet now, instead of "Can I kiss you goodnight," it's going to be "Can I text you goodnight?" And we've got high technology.
Well,
now,
there are people who obviously don't appreciate texting.
Texting's great.
Yeah, but it isn't. I mean, he did some. He's got an amazing invention. I'll just tell you about one that, if we're out in the field and deployed today, think about how important this would be. He invented a small facility that has like a balloon system in it. And what it does is, if it detects an earthquake or some other type of natural disaster, it inflates that balloon. The balloon rises up out of the little thing on a tether, and what it carries up into the air with it is a transponder that's been cabled into your telephone system. So that what happens is, in a disaster, when your towers are down, you can't talk to the people in the city, like when Katrina hit New Orleans, or what's happened in Japan, or any number of other places. These things just float up in the air, and now everyone who's in the affected area, if they have a cell phone, their cell phone service is good. They can turn it on and say, "I'm in my basement, this is where I am." They can contact someone and leave them a message, or the authorities or whomever. And so instead of the service being out in the affected area, these balloons that have the transponders on them would float over those affected areas and effectively bring that communication out. Just one thing that he invented. It hasn't been implemented yet, but I think it's a terrific idea and very timely.
You know, I think it's great. In all of the people that he's met, all of the pictures of the presidents that he has, both sides, left and right, and every place he's been, it all has to do with what went into this book. And I really believe that he's an absolute model for what America is all about. The one thing that they can't take away, the one true freedom that we have, is called the freedom of opportunity. He got onto it, and he used it to its maximum, and look what happened.
That's exactly right, and you are right. He is pictured there with presidents from both sides of the aisle, as well as many other important politicians. And the reason for that is he's very involved politically in our system. He gives contributions, but he also helps, run campaigns and gives advice. And, for example, recently the governor of the state of Maryland was looking at how much money the state owed the retirees, and they needed somebody on this panel that had, financial experience, and Aris ended up being nominated to be on that committee and has been studying the way to change the Maryland pension system to get it out of basically a $30 billion hole. So the bottom line is, he gives back. He's very, very interested in contributing to the community, and specifically at areas of education, because that's where he believes he can do the most good. So he has a scholarship fund, and he funds engineering students at the University of Maryland every year. But the thing that you noticed is, he doesn't pick one side of the aisle or the other. He's not all Republican. He's not all Democrat. He's not all independent. He meets candidates. He listens to them, and he supports them if he likes their ideas. It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're from.
No, realistically, Carl, he's an American. I mean, that's what it really boils down to. And there's got to be more people like him, so people can model. We're in a society, we're in a world that's very confused, and we need models. And that's one of the things that I think he's probably doing the best at. He's become a model, and there's probably people trying to be like him, which is a good thing, and they're off doing whatever they do, and they have certain values, and those values are strong, and nobody can push those values around. And I think that's where the real power is.
Well, you know, the title says it, God I trust, America I love, and that is what he believes, that is what he lives by, and the book tells the remarkable story of how he came here, literally, and was a dishwasher at Shakey's, which is, you know, which is a pizza parlor right down the street from the University of Maryland, worked his way up to owning a small restaurant, then a chain of convenience stores. Ultimately, he became an inventor, a developer, I mean, a very wealthy man with interests, you know, from here to Florida. He's just an extraordinary man. And he achieved that, all of it, he believes, because he was in a place where opportunity is still the cherished thing, the thing that is unique about America. You know, I wouldn't say that he loves America more than God, because it's God I trust, America I love, but they're right there together with him, and he believes those things are what gave him the opportunity to excel, and he believes those opportunities exist for every American that's still here and for every person that we could bring here. He says what you should do at college when they get a degree, either a graduate degree or an undergraduate degree, they should hand you a green card right with it. I mean, they should say, look, you've come here, you've gone to school, you've gotten educated, we need bright young minds, and they should, you know, put those people, bring them into this country and harness the enormous potential that they have, which we've done in the past, and we should continue to do in the future.
But see, the key there is if someone knows the prize at the end of the rainbow is the green card, and they go through school. This is what they're looking for. This is what they want. Then all of a sudden you've got something that's quote-unquote something that's accessible, it's manageable, and it makes it legal, which is a very important word. And if they're going to take that kind of energy out of themselves, they're going to put, you know, they're going to move forward in a direction. It just shows you what they how they feel about competing to get to belong to this country.
And once they have that education, then you know that they're going to be productive members of society, and that's what you have to have. I mean, we need this country. I mean, we have a demographic disaster on our hands. We have a gigantic group of baby boomers who've pushed their way through the demographic pipeline, and they're all now heading toward retirement. And we have a smaller group of people behind them who are responsible not just for funding our military and all of our other important governmental needs, but the retirement of all those people that have been pushed through the pipe. And so demographically, we're in the same position many other industrialized nations are. We don't have enough young people. We need young people. We need educated young people. We need productive young people. And this is where immigration is just one tool that the country needs to help balance this demographic imbalance.
But by the way, Carl, you also need incentive for those kids to stay in school. You know, we're sitting in a situation right now that the kids that we have here now that were born here, that are automatically citizens, you got a 25-35% dropout rate across the country. And in some of the major cities, it's even worse than that. So that educational system has got to have something, whatever it is, added to it for that incentive to stay in school, to become proud of what they're doing, and then move on to any kind of an ongoing and continuous education or into the field that they want to get into, whatever endeavor. But I think that in and of itself is what we're missing, because it doesn't matter what country you come from. If the incentive for staying with what you started isn't there, the value's not there, you don't do it.
And I'll tell you what the secret to that is. This is something that I did personally. It didn't involve heiress, but years ago, I got involved with the prepaid college trust program. And I brought the first bill to this Maryland legislature in order to pass that program here, and we got it passed. I sat on the board for 4 years. I was appointed by the governor. Today, we have 35,000 families enrolled in Maryland College Prepaid Trust, and we have over $1.8 billion invested for those families. And what you find is that when a family buys a contract and they say, okay, my son's only 4 or 5 years old, or my daughter's only 6 or 7 years old, but I'm buying this college contract for him, then the parents become involved. They want that money to be put to good use. They work with those children to make sure that their grades are strong and that they understand the importance of an education. And they know that it's not being given to them, that their parents are saving that money, that they're doing without other things in order to put that money aside. And so you have a very high matriculation rate for these students, and they go on to college and they go on to success. And these state college prepaid programs are a very important element in a successful plan. And like I said, in Maryland, there's over $1.8 billion saved for 35,000 families. So there's a lot of things you can do, but the most important one is involve the parents. If you get the parents involved in their children's education, that is the single most important component in making them successful.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question about it, because we all strive for one thing. We strive for identity, we strive for acceptance, and we strive for belonging. And the belonging begins with the family. You don't find it there, you're going to find it someplace else. We're just about out of time. Is there a website we can find you guys at?
Absolutely. www.GodITrustAmericaILove.com. And if you go there, you can see Eris. You can read excerpts, little parts of the chapters. You can order the book. You can hear a little speech from Ronald Reagan about immigration. We have quotes on there from all of the famous presidents, starting at Washington and ending with Obama, talking about the importance of immigration to our country. It's GodITrustAmericaILove.com, www.GodITrustAmericaILove.com. And your listeners will not be sorry. It's a wonderful read.
Wonderful. Hey, Carl Spain, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure, sir.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone, oh, that's all, oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night, oh, that's all, oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Now that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sean Phillips back with us, Yahoo Movies executive producer, predicts this might be the biggest summer box office yet. Hey, Sean, welcome back.
Well, thanks so much for having me here. Yeah, I always feel like something's going to go down on Dresser After Dark.
Well, the lights and everything. What the heck? It happens. Well, it's nighttime, and then you can. Somebody once said, "What is this, a vampire show?" I said, "No, it's just Dresser After Dark. Nobody gets bit. Maybe."
Okay. Not that you would admit to.
Oh, go. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I said not that you admit to. You know.
No.
Vampires are all the rage these days.
Never. I mean, it's not my fault. My birthday goes all the way back a few thousand years. It is not my fault. So we'll do that. By the way, movies, movies, movies. I was at, where was I? I was at Sears about 2 weeks ago. And for the first time, they were showing Avatar in 3D. You know, you could look through the lens, the glasses, and whatever. And I thought that was absolutely amazing what they can bring into your house through the technology that they have, notwithstanding what they can do in the movies today.
No, it's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it?
Absolutely.
They just keep coming faster and faster and faster. And there are a lot of actual commercials out there now kind of making fun of trying to keep up with technology and the new advancements, advancements of the gadgets. I don't know. Yeah, you kind of feel outdated anytime you buy something. You're like, did I buy it?
That's not a joke. Absolutely. No. By the time you buy it, they've got seven or eight different levels of it that you know, and then what you paid $1,000 for, you can get for $2.95 now. And you can, if you buy another one, they'll throw it in free. But one of the things I remember when the very first 3D came out, when you wore the glasses, and the very first 3D movie I saw was Buona Devil. And it was in Africa, and it was about a lion. And I remember I was I think I was in junior high school at the time. And I went over to see a friend of mine, and I said, is Billy here? And his mom said, no, he's not. He said, well, I want to go to the movies with him. And she said, what are you going to see? I said, Buona Devil. She says, he can't see those kind of movies. And that was then. This is now. What do you think is going to be hot? What are you looking at?
There are a couple of titles that the real juggernauts of the summer, and it's unavoidable that we talk about them, and that's the final Harry Potter film, you know.
Final?
The eighth movie. It's been a long time. I mean, I don't think we've seen some kids grow up on TV shows, but we've never seen anything quite like this with a movie franchise.
No. I was thinking that, you know, as long as they've been out, isn't he entitled to Social Security now?
I would think so, right? As much as he's worked. I mean, he's certainly made a lot of people a lot of money.
Well, sure. Now, by the way, when you really think about it, you know, the Harry Potters, the Pirates of the Caribbean, etc., they may have come out a lot, but there's still obviously an audience for them.
Well, it's undeniable, you know, and I think in some ways, well, the Harry Potter is interesting because, you know, the actors themselves, right, they plucked these kids out of absolute obscurity, you know, and they were just, you know, 10 and 11 years old. They've grown up in front of our eyes, but they've become better actors throughout the entire series,
sure,
which has made the movies better and better. Of course, you know, the special effects have gotten improved, and the story that the movies are based on has become more and more intense and a little more adult. And so I think it's been an interesting progression of the films becoming actual better movies and not just phenomenon, you know, that because of the book's popularity. So,
yeah, now, didn't, and by the way, I don't even like the way I have to do this anymore, but the headmaster at the school in Harry Potter one or two movies ago, quote unquote, come out of the closet?
Oh, you know, I didn't hear that. Did he
really? Yeah. You know, I'm thinking, well, you know, I can't understand why you're doing it with Harry Potter, but not the actor, the character.
Oh, really?
Yeah, check it out. Yeah.
Oh, wow. No.
Yeah.
that's interesting. No. I would have thought that was would have been a much more, I don't know, talked about.
Yeah, I caught it.
Story kind of thing.
Yeah, I caught it a couple of years ago, and I thought, that's kind of interesting. I don't know where. I don't know if that belongs in Harry Potter or not, but if that's what it is, that's what it is. So it's no telling what they're going to do with the movies today. And it seems as though if you look underneath the movies, there's always this message about something that's going on socially at the time.
Oh, that's also true. And obviously a lot has happened in this last decade. So, there's always... They do always bring that into the filmmaking. It's unavoidable, right? You know, we're all just people. We're all experiencing things outside of whatever work we're doing. And you do bring it to the office. And so the filmmakers all along have done that. Yeah, it's a fascinating observation, actually.
See, now, I'll tell you, I will never go beyond this particular point. I'm still at the point where the cowboy six-gun shoots 59,000 rounds. At the end of the movie, he doesn't kiss the girl goodbye, kisses the horse, and the bad guy gets the gun shot out of his hand. That was a long time ago. You don't remember any of those, huh?
I've seen them, but you know, not while they were going on, I have to admit.
No, I grew up with that. It was great. You know, the bad guy comes out, and the good guy fast draws and shoots the gun out of the guy's hand. And then if somebody did get shot, you never saw blood.
No, it's now you changed. Can do that. Well, it's now changed. You can't get away with not showing it now. It's just there's a craving.
No, I know. If you go all the way back to the late 50s, early 60s, this Doris Day and the Rock Hudson movies, in those days there was a law. If there was a bedroom scene, it was 1 foot on the floor.
Is that right?
That's serious. Wow. That's real.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Not today. Okay, let's go to Thor. What do you think? You think Thor is going to be the big one now?
Thor's, I think it did very well. It's just, it's not a totally known comic book franchise. You know, it was, he's a different kind of character. I liked him growing up. I liked mythology and things like that. So he was actually, I wasn't your typical comic book reader, but I did like mythology. And, you know, he's a character from Norse mythology. And the movie from what the studio said, it did better than they expected. It was a hard sell, actually. And there are three brand new comic book characters this summer as well, with Green Lantern, another very tricky backstory to try and get across, and then Captain America later in the summer. And what's interesting about these is that I think all of them have pretty good casting.
Yeah.
And so they're going to bring the characters to light best possible way, but I just don't know. What I'm fearing is that there's actually going to be a comic book fatigue for these movies. I just, how many are they going to expect the public to follow? You know, this is starting to be a lot of different characters, including like an X-Men movie that offers this whole range of different kinds of personalities, and I think there's got to come to a point where the movies aren't going to sell. It's so many. And we do have another Batman and another Superman movie coming out next summer, which are all-time favorite characters.
Who's going to be Batman?
Do you know? It's Christian Bale again.
Oh, okay. I like Christian Bale. Did you see him in this, what was it, The Fighter with Mark Wahlberg?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, but what a job. He should have gotten an Oscar. Christian Bale.
Oh, he did. He won the one. He did win the Oscar.
Oh, he did win it for that. Okay. Well,
for The Fighter. Yeah, no, it was a fabulous performance.
Yeah. Oh, what a performance he did. My goodness. And he does have a British accent, which is, I think, it's interesting. The but the job they did was unbelievable. And I think what's going on too, like Avatar. I watched Avatar. I enjoyed it. But where everybody went wild with Avatar was the special effects. The movie itself wasn't all that great, but the special effects were unbelievable, and I thought that's what connected them. So when they're going to do the 3D technology and the rest of it, they'll take all of those old things that aren't selling, and they'll customize it with technology, and all of a sudden they'll start to sell. We need to get scared and have enough excitement to make us jump out of our seats. Otherwise, we're not going to watch.
It is. It's a harder and harder sell, and you know, the people who make movies do have to spend more and more money. But we've already found that sometimes just slapping on a 3D treatment is just not going to cut it. I mean, there was a movie, the biggest culprit of this, I think, was Clash of the Titans last year, and it came only a couple months after Avatar came out. And when the movie executives learned, very quickly became aware that Avatar was just raking in the dollars. They did like a 6 or 8 week 3D treatment on Clash of the Titans, and the movie was not that strong to begin with. You know, you commented that Avatar wasn't that great, but Clash of the Titans was poor in my mind, and I loved the original Clash of the Titans with its very kind of now hokey kind of special effects. I mean, I loved how homespun they are. I still love how homespun they seem with sort of claymation action. It's great. It's fantastic. I loved it. And so they just slapped this 3D treatment on Clash of the Titans just to make, you know, some extra money. And I think there was a bit of a backlash, and the very near instantaneous momentum that 3D had with Avatar, this guy, you know, it did sort of halt some folks from saying, well, maybe we can't just do this for every film. However, I have said all that, and yet probably about every other weekend there's a movie coming out in 3D this summer.
Oh, sure, sure. You know what movie I absolutely loved that I finally saw, and it's not that new on the scene, finally saw the latest version of The A-Team. What a fun movie that was.
I mean, that's pretty much action.
Yeah.
Tied together only very loosely by a story.
Yeah, by the way, there was no story behind it. The plot was whatever the plot was. It was just so much action and fun. The actors were good, and it just rolled. Was there anything to learn out of it? No. Was there any message? I don't think so. But it was just a fun movie to watch.
I mean, did you leave with a smile on your face? That's kind of...
Absolutely, yeah.
That's the point of a lot of movies, you know, and then some movies hopefully go some other places and bring about some other emotions. But, you know, for the most part, you're trying to get a little... I don't know, separation from what's going on in reality, and just put a smile on your face and on your mind. Actually, you know,
sure. Sort of for myself, I like a lot of action. I don't have to think. I like to put it on and just sit back and just completely become a vegetable and get involved in it. Isn't that what it's for?
Thank goodness there is a balance of other movies too, though, because I think you need all. You need to explore the art form. And you know, sort of all its beauty.
Oh, what is it that you've seen recently that you really loved, that left an impact on you?
Wow, that's a good question. I think I'm yearning for that, to be truthful. There have been things I've really liked. I mean, we just spoke of the action film, and I thought Fast Five very much delivered. It delivered in a big way as far as car chases, explosions, and some big action stars facing off. Definitely left with a smile on my face, but you know, it doesn't sort of haunt me. You know, I haven't seen a movie recently that really haunts me and makes me just kind of keep pondering it and trying to decipher the choices made in the movie and just how it made me feel. You know,
sure.
By the way, my
favorite movie
while,
of so all times, and
I'm
I will watch it again.
Maybe there's a movie actually coming out this summer. It's a Terrence Malick film. He did Thin Red Line. That's just kind of his most notorious film. This one stars Brad Pitt and Sean Penn, and it's a very different kind of movie to present in the summertime. It is sort of the anti-blockbuster, and it's very difficult. I mean, we debuted the trailer on Yahoo Movies, and it's really difficult to exactly see what the movie's all about, which I think is fantastic. I love a little more.
Is this a remake? Is this a remake of the Thin Red Line?
No. From what I understand, this is just a total concept from his mind, and you know, obviously, it has some really solid actors, some actors people really like, and it's being considered Oscar bait already, and that's sort of the nature of how people like to categorize for sure, but it might be a movie that makes you think. And you know, I enjoy personally the blend of the movies that, you know, where you can go in numb and enjoy, and then the others that, where the messages, well, I was going to say the messages linger, but in some cases, what lingers is you trying to figure out the message.
Sure. Oh, no, I love that. My favorite movie, all-time movie, I've seen the movie probably, if I've seen it 50 times, I've seen it a lot. If it comes back on TV every once in a while on Turner Classic Movie, I will see it again. My favorite movie of all time was A Quiet Man with John Wayne. The Quiet Man.
That's a quality film, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely my favorite movie, because there were certain scenes in that you could see that whatever happened during the filming, he got a little surprise and his face looked a little strange. But for the most part, I loved the movie. It was just innocent. It was there. It was fine. There were some fights in it, but there wasn't any killing and blood and whatever, because I truly believe, Sean, today, and the A-Team, yeah, I enjoyed the action and whatever, but there's so much violence in the movies. What are these kids going to learn? Violence. What are they going to learn? How are they going to learn how to handle things? Violence. And you see what happens. And I don't believe that there should be restrictions in what people can see. I'm not anywhere near that. But it's at the same time, you know what's going on based on what the culture is. And if you watch a movie, you can tell what the culture is, because they're going to create it for the dollars, and they're only going to do it in a way that they know that a certain segment of the population is going to pay money to see it.
I mean, tough to argue with that. What I will say, what is encouraging to me on this particular note, is that documentary filmmaking is becoming more and more accepted by the masses. It's honestly, year after year, a more and more interesting category at the Academy Awards, and it's getting a lot more... more elevated kind of essence to it, you know, and an acceptance as an entertainment form and not just some sort of weird teaching tool, you know, some sort of thing that you had to grind it out and watch in class, you know, back in the day. So you have a lot of very enthusiastic and talented filmmakers that are using some of the same techniques and creating like storylines in their documentaries that is making that particular genre more interesting. And I think it's actually, you know, and a lot of some of our best social statements are coming from documentaries, and some of our best investigative examples are coming from documentaries. And so I think there's definitely a certain segment, and even a young segment, that's kind of being galvanized by that brand of filmmaking. You know, I'm encouraged by it, and it is something that I'm seeing, you know, that the popularity of that genre is definitely growing.
Oh, I hear you loud and clear. Sean, we're starting to run out of time. I love talking to you. Website we can find you at?
Well, it's at movies.yahoo.com. We have a great summer movie guide. We've only touched on a few of the titles, but there you can explore a lot of video. We do a lot of original writing. We'll get you really clued in to whatever your interests are this summer. So come visit us at movies.yahoo.com.
Thank you so much. Hey, don't be a stranger. We want you to come back.
Hey, I'll come back anytime. Wonderful. Anytime you ring, I'm here for you.
Thank you. Good night.
All right. Take care.
The music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this bit. That's all there is. There isn't any more.
And I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, for tonight is a wrap.
The moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and love.